This is Kurt Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Everyone loves a Halloween story, and our volunteers have got a few to tell you. So, welcome to the TRRS Midnight Macabre. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Listen to TRRS for announcements about program times, or check our website at www.triangleReadingService.org to review our complete schedule. Or call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138.
So who's with me tonight?
I'm Gus Allen.
Hi, I'm Mary Beth Holman.
Cole Russell.
I'm Nancy Jones.
Hi, I'm Jim Cronin.
Hi, this is Hannah Sullivan. Ghost in the Alley, an excerpt from Spooky Canada, as retold by S.E. Schlosser. Rumors were rife about the alleyway behind the tavern. It was haunted, folks said, haunted by the ghost of a young girl who had been found murdered there. People avoided the alley after dark, for the spirit was said to be a vengeful one. Of course, no one could name anyone who had ever been killed by the ghost, but the tales were enough to keep people away from the alley at night. Fortunately for the owners of the tavern that backed onto the alley, their front door faced a well-lit road, so business was not slack. One night, when the tavern was full of drinkers, a nasty character named O'Hare wandered into the bar. Women and children were not safe in his presence, but especially not women. After O'Hare had consumed far too much alcohol, he suddenly announced that he'd seen a pretty young thing in the alley out back of the tavern. The bartender froze in the middle of polishing a glass, and the men around the bar exchanged covert glances. They didn't say a word, but they were all thinking about the ghost of the vengeful young girl. The men looked down at their glasses as O'Hare stumbled to his feet. No one made a move to stop him as he left the bar, each man quietly thinking, he deserves what's coming to him. Shortly, a horrible scream came from the alley. Everyone in the tavern looked up in shock and fear. Was there really a ghost out there? Or was O'Hare up to his old tricks and even now accosting one of their women folk? The men leapt to their feet and raced to the back door of the tavern. Pouring out into the street, they were startled by an unnatural cold, and their eyes were dazzled by a blaze of light. The bartender thrust his way to the front of the crowd and saw O'Hare's body lying in a pool of bright white light. His throat had been torn to pieces, and blood was gushing into the alleyway. Above O'Hare hovered the semi-transparent figure of a young girl, her eyes gleaming with red fire, her mouth covered with blood. She glared down at O'Hare and then turned to look at the crowd. She licked the blood from her lips, her eyes hungrily searching the bartender's neck. Then she vanished, taking the light with her. O'Hare gasped his last breath and died at the crowd's feet. The local authorities were summoned to deal with O'Hare's body. Though skeptical at first about the ghost, they were finally convinced it had appeared, since so many eyewitnesses had seen it hovering over the dying man. The memory of the ghost's hungry stare haunted the bartender all that evening. Upon rising the next morning, he resigned his position and took a job across town.
Saxe Bridge, a true Pennsylvania ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. I don't know what exactly draws me back to Saxe Bridge each time I visit Gettysburg. I just know that I feel compelled to drive there and take pictures. Of course, it is a beautiful spot, a covered bridge that was used by the Confederate Army to cross the creek when they withdrew from Gettysburg. But after all, how many pictures can you take of the same place? Well, okay, if you're a photographer, that's a silly question. Hundreds in all weather, season, lighting. But really, I'm only an amateur. So why I personally felt compelled to record the bridge over and over was a mystery my girlfriend was obsessing about as she drove through the darkening countryside one evening in the late fall. Of course, the bridge was supposed to be haunted, so that was definitely part of the draw it had for me. According to the legend, three Confederate soldiers convicted of being spies were hanged from the beams in the covered bridge, and their bodies were discovered by Union soldiers patrolling the area. Their spirits were said to haunt the bridge, though other folks claimed they sometimes smelled General Lee smoking his pipe when they were standing on the bridge. I'd actually smelled pipe smoke there once myself, and that was one of the reasons I kept coming back to the haunted bridge. As we came to the bridge, a chill blasted over my skin in spite of the warmth flowing into the car from the heater. The bridge, usually a friendly spot, seemed sinister and dark. I felt uneasy, as if a foul presence was on that bridge and did not want us to intrude there. "I changed my mind," I said quickly as my girlfriend stopped the car. "I don't want to take pictures here after all." "What?" my girlfriend practically screeched, staring at me in amazement. "After you made such a big fuss about it? After you forced me to look at every single solitary picture you ever took of this bridge before we came to Gettysburg? No way, honey. I could be back at the hotel drinking beer right now, but no, we had to come to the bridge. Out you get and take your photos." She was right, I guess. Silly to come all this way and not take the pictures. But I was utterly terrified to step out onto the bridge. My hand shook as I reached for the door handle and shook again as I secured my camera. Praying with all my might that whatever dark power was out there would leave me alone, I leapt out the door and aimed my camera practically at random down the length of the bridge. It was completely empty of everything but me and the car as I took several snapshots, but I could feel someone, a very nasty someone, standing right behind me, willing me to leave or die. Their presence throbbed at me in almost a physical way, and my skin crawled desperately. I didn't dare turn around. I couldn't. I just whirled my camera around, aimed it over my shoulder, and snapped a picture, fast. Then I leapt back into the car before whoever, or whatever, decided to grab me and gasped, "Get me out of here, now!" My girlfriend took one look at my white face, filled with eye-popping terror, and got me out of there immediately. I didn't stop shaking until we were safely back in our hotel room for the night. When I loaded up the digital pictures on my laptop computer the next morning, I went immediately to the pictures of the Saxe Bridge, unsure of what I would see. In the first photo, a little boy in period costume stood an arm's length away from the camera. He was glaring at me with a twisted little face and an evil grin. He certainly hadn't been there when I took the picture, yet he looked solid enough to be real. The second photo was filled with misty figures that looked like phantoms. Creepy. I shuddered as I looked at them and quickly went to the next photo, the one I took over my shoulder without turning around. I gave a shriek of fear which brought my girlfriend crashing into the room. "What is it?" she shouted as I pointed a shaking finger at the screen of the laptop. Pictured on it was a filmy, dark figure, half human, half beast, with blazing orange eyes filled with such menace and hatred that it made my stomach roil. He appeared so close to the camera that he must have been directly behind me. He looked like the devil. My girlfriend's eyes popped and she gasped, "Delete it! Delete it now!" Yet, how could I delete it? I had captured pictures of ghosts on my camera. Was it worth the fright I'd had? I wasn't sure about that. Still, I couldn't delete them. My girlfriend refused blankly to look at the photos more than once, and she swore never to take me to Saxe Bridge again. But I may go back there someday.
Screaming Jenny, a West Virginia ghost story, retold by Essie Schlosser. The old storage sheds along the tracks were abandoned shortly after the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad was built, and it wasn't long before the poor folk of the area moved in. The sheds provided shelter, of a sort, although the winter wind still pierced through every crevice, and the small fireplaces that the poor constructed did little to keep the cold at bay. A gentle, kindly woman named Jenny lived alone in one of the smaller sheds. She had fallen on hard times, and with no family to protect her, she was forced to find work where she could and take whatever shelter was available to someone with little money. Jenny never had enough to eat, and in winter her tiny fire barely kept her alive during the cold months. Still, she kept her spirits up and tried to help other folks when they took sick or needed food, sometimes going without herself so that another could eat. One cold evening in late autumn, Jenny sat shivering over her fire, drinking broth out of a wooden bowl, when a spark flew from the fire and lit her skirts on fire. Intent on filling her aching stomach, Jenny did not notice her flaming clothes until the fire had burnt through the heavy wool of her skirt and began to scorch her skin. Leaping up in terror, Jenny threw her broth over the licking flames, but the fluid did nothing to douse the fire. In terror, Jenny fled from the shack and ran along the tracks, screaming for help as the flames engulfed her body. The station was not far away, and instinctively Jenny made for it, hoping to find someone to aid her. Within moments, her body was a glowing inferno, and Jenny was overwhelmed by pain. Her screams grew more horrible as her steps slowed. She staggered blindly onto the tracks just west of the station, a ball of fire that barely looked human. In her agony, she did not see the glowing headlight of the train rounding the curve or hear the screech of the brakes as the engineer spotted her fire-eaten figure and tried to stop. A moment later, her terrible screams broke off as the train mowed her down. Alerted by the whistle, the crew from the station came running as the engineer halted the train and ran back down the tracks toward poor dead Jenny, who was still burning. The men doused the fire and carried her body back to the station. She was given a pauper's funeral and buried in an unmarked grave in the local churchyard. Within a few days, another poverty-stricken family had moved into her shack, and Jenny was forgotten. Forgotten, that is, until a month later, when a train rounding the bend west of the station was confronted by a screaming ball of fire. Too late to stop, the engineer plowed over the glowing figure before he could bring the train to a screeching halt. Leaping from the engine, he ran back down the tracks to search for a mangled, burning body, but there was nothing there. Shaken, he brought his train into the station and reported the incident to the station master. After hearing his tale, the station master remembered poor, dead Jenny and realized that her ghost had returned to haunt the tracks where she had died. To this day, the phantom of Screaming Jenny still appears on the tracks on the anniversary of the day she died. Many an engineer has rounded the curve just west of the station and found himself face to face with the burning ghost of Screaming Jenny as once more she makes her deadly run towards the Harper's Ferry station, seeking in vain for someone to save her.
Piano Playing, excerpted from Spooky Campfire Tales, retold by S.E. Schlesinger. Da-da-dum-dum-blot. Charlie winced when his wife hit the wrong note on the piano for the 32nd time that day. He knew it was the 32nd time because he'd kept count as he went about his daily chores, cleaning the lighthouse, checking the supplies, mending the rowboat. Charlie blamed himself for his wife's latest obsession. He should have never taken Myrtle to attend the concert when that high-flutin' concert pianist came to town. But it was a special occasion, and everyone they knew was going. So Charlie and Myrtle went too. And Myrtle decided right then and there that what she wanted more than life itself was to play the piano. Charlie tried to talk her out of it. No one in Myrtle's family was any good at music. But Myrtle was stubborn. If she couldn't find a dadgum way, she'd make one. Before Charlie could count to 10, she'd bought a cheap, used piano. It was always out of tune, and hauled it over to the island on her brother Jamie's fishing boat. From that day on, it was practice, practice, practice. Morning, noon, and night, Myrtle sat at the piano with her piano book open, plunking away at the keys. At first, there was not much to hear, and Charlie could ignore the sour sounds. But after a few months, she got better. and a lot worse. There were parts of her song that sounded pretty good, but she never, ever got that one line right. There was nowhere on the small island that Charlie could go to get away from the sound of the piano. Even when he sat in his favorite rocker out in the woodshed with cotton in his ears, Myrtle's new hobby was the source of much contention between the husband and wife, who had never argued before in their entire lives. Now they argued every day about Myrtle's piano playing. "At least try to learn another song," Charlie begged his wife. But Myrtle was stubborn. "I ain't going to learn another song until I've mastered this one. You've got to practice to get better, Charlie." And Myrtle went back to her piano and started playing again. Da-da-dum-dum-blat. Dum-dum-blat-blat-ding. Things came to a head the day a nor'easter roared down on the island. Charlie and Myrtle were holed up together in the lighthouse hour after hour after hour. Charlie had nothing to do but sit and carve decoy ducks. And Myrtle played the piano. Hour after hour after hour. Around 4 p.m., Charlie leapt to his feet and shouted at his wife to stop playing the blasted song. Myrtle leapt to her feet and shouted that she was going to practice until she got it right. Something in Charlie snapped. Afterward, he felt bad about the way he chopped up the piano with his axe. After all, it was a valuable instrument. Try as he might, he couldn't feel bad about doing the same to Myrtle. Charlie put on his oilskins, took up a shovel, and dug a grave out back of the woodshed. He buried all the little pieces of Myrtle with all the little pieces of her piano. He figured she would have wanted it that way. That night, with the nor'easter raging and pounding the island, and the little lighthouse rattling and shaking wildly in the blast, Charlie got the best sleep he'd had in months. No more piano playing, ever. After the nor'easter blew itself out, Charlie spent the rest of the day cleaning the blood off the floor and walls of the lighthouse. After that, he did his daily duties and carefully noted in the logbook that Myrtle had been swept out to sea by a huge wave while patrolling the beaches, helping Charlie look for shipwrecks. In the middle of the night, Charlie was startled awake by a familiar sound. Da-da-dum-dum-blat. Dum-dum-blat-blat-ding. He sat bolt upright with an oath. It sounded just like Myrtle playing on the piano. This was impossible, since she was buried behind the woodshed. Charlie leapt out of bed and felt around for his axe. Blast! He must have left it in the woodshed. He picked up a large piece of firewood and carefully stepped through the door into the main room. To his astonishment, he saw a glowing, green, translucent piano standing in the place where Myrtle had put it. The keys of the ghostly piano were playing all by themselves. Dum, 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 blat. Dum, dum, blat, blat, ding. Then he heard Myrtle's voice from the stairway leading up to the light. Charlie, I told you, and I told you, I ain't going to learn another song until I've mastered this one. You should have listened to me. Charlie whirled around and gazed up the stairs. Standing a third of the way up was the translucent white figure of his dead wife. And in her hands, she held his axe.
Milk Bottles, a California ghost story retold by S.E. Schlosser. She was just another poor, bedraggled woman, struggling to feed her family. He saw them all the time, their faces careworn and blank. The Depression had created hundreds of them. He was one of the lucky ones who still had his grocery and money coming in to feed his family. She came one day to his shop, carrying two empty milk bottles, and wordlessly placed them on the counter in front of him. He took the empties and replaced them with full bottles, saying, 10 cents, please. She did not reply. She just took the bottles and left the shop. He might have gone after her to demand his money, or called the police, but he did neither. Her need was in her face, and he always felt a little guilty at being one of the lucky ones with money and a job. She was probably one of the migrant workers, he decided. She was back the next day with two empty milk bottles. He replaced them with full bottles and watched as she hurried out the door. She looked so worried that he wondered if she had a job at all. If she came back, he would offer her a part-time position cleaning the store. She came again the next morning and exchanged her empty bottles for full without saying a word. He tried to talk to her, to ask if she wanted a job, but she practically ran from the store with the milk. Her urgency worried him. He followed, wondering what he could do to help. To his surprise, she headed away from the migrant camp outside of town. She went instead to the graveyard by the river. As he watched, she hurried up to a stone marker and then disappeared into the ground. He rubbed his eyes in disbelief. Then he heard the muffled cry of a baby. It was coming from the ground, underneath the stone marker where the woman had disappeared. He ran to the store and phoned the police. Within minutes, the graveyard was swarming with people, and the workers started digging up the grave. When the casket was opened, the store owner saw the woman who had visited his store lying dead within it. In her arms, she held a small baby and two full milk bottles. The baby was still alive.
Blackbeard's Ghost, a North Carolina ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. The nefarious pirate Blackbeard, whose real name was Edward Teach, was a tall man with a very long black beard that covered most of his face and extended down to his waist. He tied his beard up in pigtails adorned with black ribbons. He wore a bandolier over his shoulders with three braces of pistols, and sometimes he would hang two slow-burning cannon fuses from his fur cap that wreathed his head in black smoke. Occasionally he would set fire to his rum using gunpowder, and he would drink it, flames and all. Many people thought he was the devil incarnate. In November 1718, Blackbeard retreated to his favorite highway, called Teach's Hole, off Arocococ Island. There he hosted a wild pirate party with drinking and dancing and large bonfires. The party lasted for days, and several North Carolina citizens sent word to Governor Alexander Spotswood of Virginia. Governor Spotswood immediately ordered two sloops, commanded by Lieutenant Robert Maynard of the Royal Navy, to go to Arocococ and capture the pirate. On November 21, 1718, Maynard engaged Blackbeard in a terrible battle. One of Maynard's ships was between Blackbeard and freedom. Blackbeard sailed his ship, the Adventure, in towards shore. It looked like the pirate was going to crash his ship, but at the last second the ships eased through a narrow channel. One of the pursuing Navy ships went aground on a sandbar when they tried to pursue the Adventure. Blackbeard fired his cannons at the remaining ship, and many of Maynard's men were killed. The rest he ordered below deck under the cover of the gun smoke, hoping to fool the pirates into thinking they had won. When the pirates boarded the ship, Maynard and his men attacked the pirates. Outnumbered, the pirates put up a bloody fight. Blackbeard and Maynard came face to face. They both shot at each other. Blackbeard shot and missed Maynard, but Maynard's bullet hit the pirate. Blackbeard swung his cutlass and managed to snap off Maynard's sword blade near the hilt. As Blackbeard prepared to deliver the death blow, one of Maynard's men cut Blackbeard's throat from behind. Blackbeard's blow missed its mark, barely skimming Maynard's knuckle. Infuriated, Blackbeard fought on as the blood spouted from his neck. Maynard and his men rushed the pirate. It took a total of 5 gunshots and about 20 cuts before Blackbeard fell down dead. Maynard seemed to think that the only way to ensure that Blackbeard was dead was to remove his head. They hung the head from the bowsprit and threw the pirate's body overboard. As the body hit the water, the head hanging from the bowsprit shouted, "Come on, Edward!" And the headless body swam 3 times around the ship before sinking to the bottom. From that day to this, Blackbird's ghost has haunted Teach's Hole, forever searching for his missing head. Sometimes the headless ghost floats on the surface of the water or swims in and around Teach's Hole, glowing just underneath the surface. Sometimes folks see a strange light coming from the shore on Pamlico Sound side of Arukakuk Island and know that it is Teach's light. On nights that the ghost light appears, if the wind is blowing inland, you can still hear Blackbird's ghost tramping up and down and roaring, "Where's my head?"
Screaming Tunnel, an Ontario ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. There is a tunnel under the old railroad tracks just to the west of Queen Elizabeth Way in Niagara Falls. It is known locally as the Screaming Tunnel. A path wanders through the tunnel and then up into an empty field on the hill. But the field was not always empty. At one time, a large farmhouse stood in the field at the top of the hill, and in it lived a happy family. Then, one night, the house caught fire. A young daughter was trapped in the house, and the only way to escape was through a wall of flames. The brave young girl covered her face with her arms and ran into the fiery doorway. Her long hair and her long nightgown began to smolder as she burst through the flames and rushed out of the house. When the night air struck her smoldering clothes, they burst into flames, enveloping the girl in a raging inferno. The girl screamed in agony and ran blindly down the hill, away from the fire-stricken house. She staggered into the tunnel under the train tracks, her screams echoing and re-echoing through the night. Overcome by the flames, the girl fell to the floor of the tunnel, wailing in agony. She rolled frantically on the floor of the tunnel, trying to douse the flames, but her efforts were weak and ineffective. She was quickly overcome and burned to death in the tunnel under the tracks. After that night, anyone that dares strike a match in the tunnel under the tracks will hear the agonized death screams of the burning girl, and a ghostly wind will instantly blow out the match.
You've been listening to a session of Midnight Macabre on Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. If you want to check out our program guide, please visit our website at www.triangleReadingService.org. While you're there, you might notice we have several programs on podcast. Meanwhile, this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Kurt Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. From me and from my fellow readers, good night.